This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Equality is a principle which has been distorted and misunderstood by many people. And that, in fact, people aren't equal. And we're not going to go into any kind of philosophical discussion about equality, except in as much as it affects us. Not only are people not equal, but I mentioned last night to the Shabbaton people, where we had 40 people sitting around, 40 young men and women. And I said, now, if everybody is equal, then I've got to assume that everybody deserves an equal opportunity to understand what I'm saying. And they nodded their heads in agreement. And I said, that means I must be careful to speak on the level of the lowest person present. Because if I speak on a level a little bit above the lowest person present, then there's going to be somebody who won't have an opportunity to understand. And they disturbedly nodded their heads in agreement. And then I said, but that's not equal. That means the only person I'm being fair to is the one on the very bottom. Anybody who's more intelligent is wasting his time. Is that equal opportunity? That you've got 40 people sitting there, and I'm wasting 39 people's time, and I'm talking to one person. So what then must I do? Got to be selective. And I said to them, I would rather have one person who really understands what I'm saying and it makes an impression on me, and 39 not understand a word of what I'm saying, then have 40 people who hear more or less and they get a nice feeling and they go out and that's the end of it. If one's talking with the idea of having some kind of an impression on people, one selects where the best chances are. One can go into a business, one can go into a very general sort of business, but you can't decide that all business opportunities are equally likely to succeed. You've got to choose the ones at which you're most likely to have success and concentrate on those and ignore the others. That's why one must be careful that the principle of equality does not disturb one's interpersonal behavior and relationships. I remember two boys from South Africa went to yeshiva in Israel. One was from a wealthy family and one was from a poor family. And the one from a wealthy family was being treated like a king. And the one from a poor family was being treated like a pauper. And I went to visit them when they were studying and they were battling. They'd only been there a few months. And the one from the poor family called me aside. He said, look, if this is Torah, I'm not interested. Just because I'm from a poor family, I've got no chavruses. Nobody takes any notice of me. Nobody cares about me. Look at him. We came here together. We're on about the same sort of standard. And look how they treat him. He's given a room immediately. And he's got chavruses. And he's got access to the Rosh Hashiva. And they take care of him. And they ask how he's doing. And he has dinner with the Rosh Hashiva on Friday nights from now and again. I've never seen the Rosh Hashiva. I thought that was rather disturbing and I challenged the Rosh Yeshiva. And he said to me very simply, he said, there are 200 boys in my yeshiva. And I have time for 25. There's no way that I can educate more than 25. If I try and educate more than 25, I'm not going to educate anybody. So all I can do is I can try and educate 25. He says, on what basis do I choose which 25 I'm going to concentrate on? This is not the money. Among the 25, you'll find many boys who are from poorer families than the boy you're talking about. So, but what can I do? The boy from a wealthy family, as it happens, I get a letter from his father every week. How's the boy doing? What's going on? Please take care of him. Please see that he's learning. Please write to me if there are any problems. And the other boy, another thing. From the boy who's from the wealthy family, he comes up to me, asks questions, nags me, persists. The boy from the poor family, I've never seen him, he never comes to me. The boy from the wealthy family, if he goes into town, this is the yeshiva that is up in the kundu, if he goes into town, he knocks on my door and he asks my wife, is there anything you need in town? The boy from the poor family never does. But surely I've got to choose, as my chances of success, my first obligation is to those who are making the effort. And I understood and I explained to the one from the poor family who didn't accept it. If we're going to accept that people are not to be treated equally, what measure or what should determine who gets special attention and who's treated as one of the masses? Because ultimately you can treat two people in two broad categories. A number, one is the masses, a statistic, or an individual. Yes, there's a grey area in between how much individual, how much attention, how much time. But one's basic relationship to a person is to a member of a group or as an individual. And to relate as individuals, certainly in the educational business, the number of individuals that one can handle is limited. That's the first philosophical question which we're posing. The second question is a very interesting question. The Ten Commandments, the first two of the Ten Commandments, is really strange. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt from the land of slavery. That's it. Is that a commandment? Number one, it's not a commandment either. Okay. In Hebrew, as a matter of fact, they're not called commandments, they're called dibrot, statements. It's a statement. I am the Lord your God, it's a theology. There is a sinister implication, which of course is not correct. But if one just reads it simply, there's a sinister implication that I am the one who took you out of Egypt. There might be other gods, but I'm the one who took you out of Egypt. A disturbing sort of implication. Let's go on to the second one. There shall be no other gods. You shall have no gods of others before me. What does that mean? These are ten statements, and the first one is the statement that I am the Lord your God. The second statement should be, there are no other gods. What does it mean? You shall not have other gods before me. Again, almost a sinister implication that there may well be other gods, but you should not relate to them and you should not have anything to do with them. Of course, that's not what it means. But there's a funny sort of implication. It goes on, you mustn't make idols, you mustn't bow down to them, because I am a jealous God, which is a funny thing too. I do kindness to thousands who love me, and I visit with punishment and sons and grandsons and great-grandsons to those who hate me. And finally, why did God take such exception to idolatry? If we hold that idolatry is nothing, an idol has no power at all. An idol is a piece of wood. If an idol is a piece of wood, what does it bother God? What does it bother God if a Meshuggah bows down to the piece of wood? It's a meaningless action. It doesn't mean anything. If the piece of wood had power, then God can get worried. He's relating to that God and not to me. But if the piece of wood has no power in any case, it's a meaningless nothing. Why does God get so upset about idolatry and he calls anybody who serves idolatry those who hate me? When one counts something, on the one hand it indicates a certain preciousness. Because something which is not precious you don't count, you weigh. If you've got little pieces of glass, you weigh it. If you've got diamonds, you count them. On the other hand, it makes you part of the statistic. Fill out a census form and somebody comes and collects it, and that's it, you figure somewhere on a computer. Yeah, and in the center there's a lot that goes on today with the whole business of counting. Which on the one hand is a compliment, and on the other hand is a bit of a humiliation. Counting is one of these funny things that is both a compliment and a bit of a humiliation. That answers your question of earlier. And then we're told in the Sedra that you're not to count the Levim. The Levim are not to be counted. And Moshe gets very worried and he thinks there's something wrong with the Levim. Says the Medrash, Be'et Roshan lo tisa betot b'nei Yisrael, and you shall not count them among the people of Israel. Lama? Why not? Says the Medrash, Shehalevim shelihe. It is the Levim are mine. You are not to count them. Why? What's it all about? Listen to the Medrash. Bahayu li halevim, the Levim are mine. What does that mean? Shekol mishuhu mekarev oti, ani mekarvo. Anybody who draws himself, who draws me near to him, I draw him near to me. So we see a reciprocity on the part of God. So God relates individually to those who draw close to him. Hem karvu atzman li, they brought themselves closer to me. No, they brought themselves closer to me. What are we talking about? A person who is makarev the Ribbono Shel Olam. He starts off, listen to the words carefully. Mishu makarev oti, He who brings me closer to him, I will bring him closer to me. And then he quotes as an example the Levim who karvu atman li, they brought themselves closer to me. The way you bring God closer to you is by getting closer to him. You don't sit where you are and say, come, come, God, there's a place for you here next to me. That's not what one does with the Ribbono Shel Olam, or with anybody greater than oneself. You want to be Mekarev, if you want to be come close to somebody greater than yourself, you get up to them. Don't pull them down to you. So the way that they brought God to them was coming close to him. Shneimar, as it says, Vayomer Moshe, Mila Hashem Elai. After the golden calf, when it was a question of having to do some destructive work there, Moshe gets up and he says, who is for God? To me. Vayatu Elav Kol B'nei Levi, and all the tribe of Levi came. Hein Kervu Ati, they brought me close to them, Va'ani Mekalvan, and I will bring them close to me, Va'ayu Li Halavi. Levi Im Omai. So because they made an effort to draw closer to God, God in turn makes them his own, his favorite. And then the Midrash said a strange thing. The Lord came. And not only that, but even more so. They have been found to be loyal to me. Sheshomru az harotzi, they kept away from my warning. Lo yiyye lecho Elohim acherim. There should be no other gods in front of me. Therefore they should be the trusted one with my heart. What did the Midrash say? Not only did they draw me close to them, but they didn't even serve idolatry. Which is great. Serving idolatry is the basis. Everybody, nobody's allowed to serve idolatry. And there's a higher level of coming close to God. But according to the Midrash, it's the other way around. Not only did they come close to me, but you know what else they did, says the Midrash? They even kept away from the second commandment. They didn't transgress the second commandment with the same commandment. It's strange. My father spoke last Friday night about the midah of ne'emanus, of loyalty. And it struck me at that time that the midah of ne'emanus is at one and the same time the most important of all midahs. The most important of all characteristics. I'll explain why. And at the same time, regretfully, the midah most neglected today. And I'm going to show you this evening that without ne'emanus, without the midah of loyalty, there's nothing. There cannot be a society, there cannot be a religion, there cannot be progress. An individual cannot progress without ne'emanus, without loyalty. I'm also going to show you that ne'emanus is a midah. There's no such thing as I'm loyal to my shul, and I'm loyal to the Ribbono Shel Olam, but I'm not loyal to my business. Or I'm loyal to my club, but I'm not loyal to my family. Or I'm loyal to my family, but I'm not loyal to my country. There's no such thing. There's no such thing as I'm arrogant to so-and-so, and I'm humble to so-and-so. Well, you're either arrogant or you're humble. You're humble. It's a quality of being. It's a midah. A person either has the midah of loyalty, or he doesn't have the midah of loyalty. And if a man doesn't have the midah of loyalty, he doesn't have it at all. And if he does have it, he has it everywhere. And today, the most lacking midah of all, in all spheres, is the midah of loyalty. We're going to have to define what loyalty means, what loyalty is, and most important, draw the line between loyalty and cultivation. Because loyalty can very easily become an exclusive sort of cultivation. The first amazing thing is that the Midrash regards loyalty as the greatest midah of the Levim. They were loyal to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Ne'emonim, nimtzu imi ne'emonim. They were found to be loyal to him. That's number one. And that was the greatest midah. But even more remarkable than that, the Midrash gives us pshat in the second commandment. The second commandment is thou shalt be loyal. That's what it means. Because he says here, not only that, but they were found loyal to me because they kept my commandment, lo yiyye lecho Elohim acherim. That means that the second commandment is the commandment of thou shalt be ne'emanim. That's what it means. It's not the prohibition of idolatry. The prohibition of idolatry is not the essence of that commandment. The essence of that commandment is thou shalt be loyal. And then we understand The second commandment is not going into the theological question of how many gods there are. That's irrelevant. Maybe there are more gods. There's another pasuk of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. That's somewhere else in the Torah. That's not what the second commandment is dealing with. And it's not even what the first commandment is dealing with. The second commandment is, I don't care how many gods there are, you're going to be loyal to me. That's the second commandment. On what is loyalty based? Let's look at the first part of the Midrash. Because it seems that the law of is a quantitative increase. Not only that, but also this. Not that the Midrash is not going on to a completely new Midrash, but it implies that the beginning of the Midrash is in fact the same Midrash, but not to the same extent as later on. The second Midrash is loyalty. What's the first Midrash? They came close to me, and I came close to them. And the essence of it is the Rebbeinu Shalom, and Shalom says, Lama, why? Shehalavim Shalihet, they belong to me. And there you have the principle of the basis of loyalty. Loyalty is a feeling of belonging. I belong to him. I am the Rebbeinu Shalom. I belong to him. When you belong to someone, you can't offer. There's no way that you can belong and run away. That's the concept of a slave. Forever. You can't have an object, you can't have a cow, and a cow runs away and it's no longer yours. You have it, if something belongs to you, it's yours until you choose to get rid of it. And the concept of ne'emonus is a feeling of belonging. Not just belonging in the way it's normally used in a sociological sense, but in a deep psychological, spiritual sense. I belong in a halakhic sense, even. I belong to the Ribbono Shel Olam. I am his kinyan. I belong to him. That's part of what Shavuot is all about. Now we understand the first commandment. The first commandment is, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. Forget about other gods. We're not talking about them. We'll discuss somewhere else whether there are other gods or there aren't. But I am the one who brought you out of Egypt. Without me, you would be slaves in Egypt. Therefore, Lord, you're not allowed to have any other gods, because that would be the Lord. I put you where you are. That's the principle and the start and the beginning of the Ten Commandments. That's the principle and the start and the beginning of Yiddish. And that's why in so many mitzvahs we do, we mention Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's why Pesach is so important. That's why we celebrate Pesach before Shavuot, for the whole connection and build up towards Shavuot. That's why when we say Kiddush on Shabbos, Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim. Many, many mitzvahs are Zeichel Yetzias Mitzrayim. Never forget that without God we would be nowhere. And therefore he demands loyalty from us. The seeder of loyalty. It means to feel that I belong. Without it, there's nothing. Imagine family life without loyalty. Imagine a husband who doesn't feel committed to his wife. Imagine a wife who doesn't feel committed to her husband. You know, one has to know the process of maturity, possibly. I don't know what it is. I don't know why many people find it very difficult. There are certain steps one takes in life which are irrevocable. Now, it's true one can get out of a marriage. It's true there's a divorce. But that's the shalom, that a person should go into marriage considering divorce as a possible out. That marriage is doomed from the beginning. Things don't work out, one can discuss another. And even that is not really a very good out. It's very much a bedieved sort of out because of all the damage that is done. But let's forget about that. A man and woman have to go into a marriage with the understanding that this is an irrevocable decision. You can't opt out. People are frightened of that kind of situation. It's understandable people are frightened of it. But to pretend that such situations don't exist, that's better. What one has to understand is that there are certain relationships one enters into which are permanent forever and ever and ever. And finished. That's it. The essence of loyalty is to understand that this is not just two people relating to one another. This is one person who owns the other. And that's why the kinyan for marriage is kinyan keset, one of the kinyanim, you have to do a kinyan, you purchase a wife. You pay her out. But she should understand, she's sold. She doesn't have an independent being outside of the marriage. And the husband too, the Gemara says, that kol ha-koine, the Gemara in Kiddushin, that kol ha-koine evit ivri, ki ilu koine ozen le'asim. Anybody who purchases a Jewish slave is like buying a master, because he's got to eat the same as you eat, he's got to live on the same standard as you live. If there's only one bed, he gets the bed and you sleep on the floor. So the Gemara, don't think you're getting yourself a servant if you buy a slave. He's a slave, you're getting yourself a master. Because not only does he belong to you if you buy him, but you are also committed to him. And as such, you have certain obligations from which you cannot escape. Okay, so you have a master. And if that's the case with an eved, if that's the case with a slave, how much more so with a wife? So the husband has to know that if he's purchasing a wife, if he's investing in a wife, he's getting himself a master. He too becomes committed to a marriage. He too becomes committed to someone who has a certain ownership, who has certain rights entrenched that he can do nothing about from the moment of the chuppah on. Absolutely irrevocable. Leaving aside the possibility of divorce. A feeling of belonging comes through purchase. You belong to somebody when they bought you. That's really what it is. How do you buy a person? Well, the way we buy a lady under the chuppah is very easy. You get a little gold ring. Now a gold ring costs a lot of money. A couple of years ago it didn't. It cost a few rand. And you give her the ring and you bought it. That indicates that to be bought, all you need to do is be the recipient of a shoveh pruta. If you have received from somebody the value of a pruta, which is the smallest monetary denomination, something like a cent today, if you have received from somebody the value of a cent, you must know that depending on the nature of the transaction and what you've given back, you've bought. If you give me a cent and I give you an article worth a cent, then I've received nothing from you. If you give me 1 million rand and I send you a building in Elop Street, you've given nothing to me. But if you give me a cent and I give you nothing, I've sold myself. I belong to you. That's what you bought me. One of the biggest problems in business today is lawyers. How do you keep stock? Shouldn't be a problem. There used to be a time when a man joined a company. He went to work with a family. He was there for the rest of his life. But if he wanted to move, there was a commitment. It was understood. Today you start wondering, every employee you hire, what files do you show him, what files don't you show him? How much do you let him into the secrets of your business, or don't you? When is he going to just get enough to pick himself up and start up in competition, or go to my competition and tell them everything I know? And you can have a business today, you fix a man off the street, a man is starving, and they put him on his feet, and they teach him, and they educate him, and they educate his children, and they give him a position, and he develops, and he grows, and as soon as he knows enough, he's got a bit of money, off he goes, joins the competition, because they offered him 100 grand a month extra, starts his own business. And what did he say? Business is business. Loyalty is something else, it's business. And it works the other way around as well. You can have a man who joins a company in his 20s or 30s and works for them while he's 40, 50, the best years of his life. And then he has a bit of problems, he gets ill, and he's not quite as much use to the company anymore, and they take him out and they say, yes. What's the role of a man who's built your business up? He's given up his life to this. He's given his best years. He could have been building up his own business, but he was building your business. You put him out on the street, even if you pay him. Business-wise, it might be in order. You might be paying him correctly. You might be treating him correctly. But that's disloyal. And it's disloyal the other way around, too. There's no feeling of loyalty. Can I employ a domestic servant in my home if I don't feel with a degree of loyalty? Is she going to have my keys, coffee? Is she going to give access to the house to somebody who wants to come in? Unless I can assume that there's certain loyalty, there are no interpersonal relationships. I can't talk to people, I can't give people things, I can't share things with people if I don't feel confident that there's loyalty. And today the complaint over and over again in business circles and professional circles, loyalty, loyalty, loyalty. No. A man can take and take and take and take, and when times are bad he walks out. Loyalty is the understanding that once someone is responsible for you being where you are, no matter how good or bad times are, no matter whether you could do better without him or worse without him, you surely will speak to him. That's what loyalty is. It's a commitment for life. My father was telling me of a tragic story, really, of a rabbi in America who was telling him the story. This rabbi in America was saying, you know what happens today? I've been working for 30, 40 years in my career.
So if one looks back, a young boy starts coming into shul on Shabbos, 40 years ago.
And I take an interest in him and I invite him home. And he's at my house every Shabbos. And after a while, he expresses more of an interest in himself keeping Shabbos. Causes problems at home with the family, I go to the family and we sort it out. And I teach him, and I start teaching him Chumash and Mishnah and Gemara, and I put hours and hours and hours into this young man. And only with happiness and joy. Finally, the young man decides, gets married. I find a young woman. Sorry, I jumped again. 40 years ago, people didn't become Shomer Shabbos. Put a lot of work into the young man, put a lot of work into the young lady. Finally, he gets them married, officiates at their chuppah, joins them to the reception. Sees them through the crises of their lives, the marriage is in difficulty, he goes to difficulty out. They have children, he gets a bris, he helps them raise their children, problems of education, he sorts it out. Problems between parent and child, he sorts it out. Essentially, the young man that is so raised becomes a certain interest in Yiddishkeit, becomes from the second generation, a child, and he works on the child and works and eventually persuades the child to go to yeshiva. The child goes and the parents are upset, trying to make a religious fanatic out of my son. And he goes and he sorts it out with the parents. And he gets that sorted out and the parents give the child their blessing. Off he goes to yeshiva. And then the young boy writes back to him after a year or two, he's interested in a shidduch, he wants to get married. And they all start looking around and he finds somebody suitable and he introduces them and he counsels them. And he gets it all organized. And they get engaged. Now it's time to get married. And this rabbi says with tears in his eyes, so they phone me up and they say, Rabbi, we're having the chuppah in your shul, we would like you to say a bracha under the chuppah. And he says, and who's officiating? Who's Masada Kedushin? I say, Rosh Hashim. And he says to himself, but no, this boy wouldn't be anywhere near yeshiva if it wasn't for me. But of course, Rosh Hashim is a bigger name. Of course, having the Rosh Hashim officiate at the wedding is a much bigger honor for the young couple. But is that loyalty? The Rosh Hashiva has only known him for 1 or 2 years. And here you've got, I raised him on my knees. And we've got, in fact, from this week's Seder, where the Gemara says, Ela told us Moshe the Aaron, the Torah told us these are the generations of Moshe and Aaron, and then it goes talking about the children of Aaron and doesn't mention anything about the children of Moshe. But you are said. And Rashi says on the spot, so the children of Moshe aren't mentioned because the children of Aaron are considered as the children of Moshe as well, because Moshe taught them Torah. So, and if a person teaches Ben Chabeira Torah, Ma'ale Alav HaKotos Ki'ilu Yeladus. The Torah regarded as if you taught the son of your friend's Torah, the Torah regarded as if you were the father of that child. You've given birth to that child. It's your generation, it's your children. So these are the children of Moshe and Aaron in partnership. Aaron was the father, Moshe was the Rebbe, but they share the children. This Rosh says, these are my children. I raised them, I raised their parents. And off they go because they get a bigger name. Somebody smarter, somebody posher. And my father said, you know what's even more tragic? It's the 10, 15, 20 years ago, certainly before the war, Rosh Hashanah would never agree to perform the wedding. Come to so-and-so shul, who's raised you, and I do the wedding, I'll stand there and I'll say a bracha. But you asked him to do the tradition. There's no feeling of understanding that you, for the rest of your life, are going to owe that rabbi, that little shul, everything. You belong to him. You are his, and that's the end of the story. No matter what Rosh Hashanah you hit up against, no matter what Talmid Chacham and how great you might become, that's where you started. I took you out of Egypt. That's all you need to remember. Not important where you are today. You would be nowhere today if it wasn't for me. Therefore, there's got to be another God in front of me. There's got to be explicit. That's the middle of loyalty. How far did it go? There's a Yerushalmi in Chagiga, second parak, in the beginning of the second parak of Chagiga. Rabbi Meir was the Talmud of Rabbi Elisha ben Avua. Rabbi Elisha ben Avua is a fascinating character that one doesn't know quite what to make of. And he had a very sad story. He was a big Talmud Chacham, the third generation of Talmudim approximately. Extremely outstanding person one sees. He produced a Talmud like Rabbi Meir. And then he went off the road. In fact, the Elishman already came anti-religious and violently anti-religious. He used to go into the yeshivas and try and get people out. Try and tell them how to waste their life learning in yeshivas. He used to go to the Roman authorities and report on various Talmidei Chacham and their teaching. When the Jews were put to work on Shabbat to try and break their religion by the Romans, they used to try and do their Yisurim as Yisurim de Rabbanan. For example, they would, if they were told to carry beams, to carry wood, and the Rishus HaRabim, which isn't allowed on Shabbos, two of them would carry it together. If you two carry it together, it's a good Rabbanan, it's not a good Rabbanan. And he went to the Roman authorities, and he told them, look here, if you want to really break them, see that each one carries it on his own, not to make them even more miserable. He became, you can't imagine how empty and how violent and how unpleasant in his apikus. So much so that when the Gemara refers to him, they don't refer to him as Rabbi Elisha ben Avua, they refer to him as Achel, as Adam. They don't even refer to him right now. Rabbi Meir Havar Yosef Dorash Beveis Bedrasha Dixeri. Rabbi Meir was sitting and giving a shiur to the Beit HaMedrash in Tveri. You know where Tveri is? Rabbi Meir was there for the Shabbat actually, as the Gemara said a little bit further on. And he used to give the shiur not on Mosheh Shabbos, but on Shabbos he used to give the shiur. And there he was, Rabbi Meir and the Beit HaMedrash, in the middle of the shiur. Ovar Elisha Rabbi Rachi Bal Susi Yom Shus. Elisha ben Avua came past the Beit HaMedrash riding on his horse to Rabbi Shabbos. The equivalent of one rope, that's the shogun riding past the Beit HaMedrash in a car. Atun v'amrin le. They came up to Rabbi Meir in the middle of his shiur and they whispered to him, for Rabcho Levan, your Rebbe is outside. I don't know if they did it as sort of mockery, that's just your Rebbe, or whether they really told him out of courtesy. Chosak leimin drosha. He stopped the shiur, then nofak legade and he went outside. And there's a long gemara that reports the conversation that they started walking. He walked, Rabbi Elish, on Shabbat. Rabbi Elisha ben Avua on the hook, Rabbi Meir walking next to him. They walked and they talked to him until they were out of the city. He saw him out of Tveri. And then Rabbi Elisha ben Avua said to Rabbi Meir, you must turn back to him. He said, if you go any further, it's outside the city. You're not allowed to walk more than 3,000 feet, it's outside of the city. And Rabbi Elisha ben Avua said, this is the point, you've got to turn back. Rabbi Meir said, I'm fascinated. How do you know this is the point? We've been talking and learning. I didn't even notice that we were getting there. I've noticed the point that I've been counting the steps of my horse. I know the size of the steps of my horse. I've been watching. This is 2,000. How much can you turn it? Rabbi Meir said, you're that careful and you're that clever and you won't be afraid of the sugar, you won't be sugar. And he said, no, I've heard that they won't even accept my sugar. It said upstairs that you accept anybody's sugar, you accept anybody's repentance, not that you should be able. And there's a bit of a discussion in the Gemara as to what happened to Elisha ben Avua, why he went off, and so the Gemara goes on. All I want to show you here is Ad Heichan loyalty. Where does loyalty go to? A Rebbe, Acher, who becomes a violent, horrible apikoros, a dangerous person who is trying his best to destroy Koros, comes past the Beit HaMedrash in the middle of Rabbi Meir's shiur. The matter stops for a moment. Without that man, I wouldn't be there. I've got to go out and I've got to show him honor. I don't have to agree with him. I don't have to learn his apikursus. A lot of discussion as to how Rabbi Meir managed to make sure that he was influenced only by the good teachings of Acher, not by the bad teachings of Acher. It's another subject. The point is that even so, Rabbi Meir did not flinch from the loyalty that he felt he owed Acher. It's brought down in the Yerushalmi, and part of it is brought down in the Bavli and Chagiga as an example of the relationship between Rabbi Meir and Acher. So this concept of loyalty, the Torah takes very far. The moment You are where you are because of something that somebody else gave to you. You are locked into a lifetime relationship to that person from which you can never escape. He can go off the rails, you can go off the rails, you can carry on to greater heights and exceed his height. He can go to greater heights, it makes no difference. You can go to other ends of the world. But the obligations of loyalty are not turning to you, just sadly, nothing one can do about it. Loyalty is the ability to face up to that real situation, even if it's a disturbing one. If I've been kicked off the street and been educated by my company to reach a certain level, I always have to remain loyal to that company. Leave the company, company can kick me out, whatever. But that loyalty always has to be. I can't do something which is against the principle of loyalty to the company. That's if the company has put me where I am. We're not talking about a transaction. That means that every person you do business with, you have to become loyal to. But if what you are today is because of something somebody did to you, even if it's small, the ring under the chuppah, that's what made the lady into a wife. That's what made a miss into a mistress. From a basula into a basula, somebody who's owned, who's possessed. That little ring, which she carries around with her, which she's aware of, that's what makes it a lifetime obligation, a loyalty from which one can never escape. Sometimes it works the other way around. Loyalty, we've said, is when you've received something which has put you where you are. Sometimes it works the other way around in the sense that you will not get anywhere unless you commit yourself to a relationship. Yes, once you're married, then there has to be loyalty. But you can't get married unless you get committed. It's a bit of a vicious statement. You've got to decide, I'm prepared to commit this myself to this person forever and ever. That's really what Chazut Piyut is all about. What pioneering is all about. A pioneer, what does he do? He gives up a comfortable life. He dedicates his life to building up something from scratch. He could stay where he is. He could make progress. But that's not what he chooses to do. Whether he wants to establish a yeshiva, or he wants to establish Israel as a country, or a part of Israel as a country, or he wants to go out into a community and work among the people, whatever it is. A man who does an action, who commits an action of chalut to you, the pioneering action, is a man who is selling himself to his project. He's saying, yeah, everything I've got, I'm going to put into this. And it's going to have to work, because if it doesn't work, I'm going to be a disillusioned man. Whatever I've got is going to work. When one does that, it's a dividend of grace. Now, you see, what I'm saying is that in the same way as loyalty follows upon commitment, because you've received something from it, therefore you owe the loyalty. It works the other way around the world. Invest loyalty, and you'll get the dividends too. You'll find that you benefit. That's the mentor shalom. That's the rebbeinu shalom. Why aren't I counting the levim shalavim shaliha in their mind? I bought them. They belong to me. So why did I buy them and not anybody else? There's a mentor shekol me shuhu mekarei. But see, anybody who invests himself in me, ani mekarei, then I adopt him. I take him. First step came from the Levim. They threw their lives in with the Ribbono Shel Olam, and they were prepared to give their lives for the Ribbono Shel Olam. They showed absolute unflinching loyalty to him. And as a result of that, he possessed them. In other words, they felt a sense of belonging before he even bought them. The first step was from the Levim. They felt themselves belonging to the Ribbono Shel Olam, and in response to that, the Ribbono Shel Olam said, Shelih hem, they are now. And that created the middah of ne'emonus, the middah of loyalty ultimately. One finds that all great things have been built up by pioneers. Nothing has been built up by passengers. Nothing has been built up by pedestrians. Whatever has been built up has been built up by pioneers. We have a situation even in this town, if one looks at any of the Torah institutions, any place of learning, whether it's the Kollel, or Rabbi Goldstein's yeshiva, or Rabbi Koiter's yeshiva, any place of learning that's been established from scratch, has been established with tremendous material, with commitment. Because you're not going to get anything off the ground unless you've got people committed. to do something to Achariah, to do it with the back of your hand.
See, let's try if it works. If it works very good. If it doesn't, we'll leave it. It's not going to work if it's valuable.
Something which is a valuable and a worthwhile project is only going to work when the motivators are fully behind it all that job. But such institutions, as well as businesses and countries,
face a very simple problem. The problem that Israel faces today, the problem that the South African youth movement face today, the problem that Kollel faces today, and that Arbeit for Medrash quite easily face, or does face, the others not so much because they're still newer. And that is, once the thing is moving, there's no need for that thing to move. And the Chalitziyut starts to disappear, and the loyalty starts to disappear. A man who builds a business up from scratch is loyal to the business. Find two partners going into something together, they're loyal to one another. They're starting from the bottom. And their first employees are loyal. You walk into any business and you'll say, let's say the business is 50 years old. And you'll take the list of the staff of the business, no matter how big it is. And you'll say, right, 50 years old. Cut out all those that have joined in the last 30 years. And you'll say, cut out all those that have joined in the last 10 years. That's them.
Of the others, in other words, those who've been there for more than 10 years will find a tremendous proportion of there from the beginning. Turnover comes later on. The pioneers don't have that. The man who's seen it start from the bottom, the man who's built it up from scratch, who's put his life into it, feels he belongs to it. He sold himself. He put everything he's got into it. And when you sold yourself to something, when you put your heart into it, you feel you belong with a sense of loyalty. There's nothing that can be done.
The people who come in later, jump onto the bandwagon for a little while, they take a trip, they move on, jump off when they've reached their destination, when they've been taken a little bit further, on and off. That's where you're not going to have it.
One has to understand that in a business, maybe that's how business is, but in Torah that doesn't work, because if one jumps on and off of Torah, one jumps on and off even if it's for many years, if it's with that attitude, without that commitment that we're talking about, you don't get anything out of it. The Ribbono Shel Olam makes the Levim his when they have made God theirs. That's where the first step has to come. There has to be a movement of commitment and a movement of loyalty from the people involved. See, there used to be a time, taking Arbeit for Medrash as an example, and I intended nothing more as an example, because the same applies in any organization, any business, and any family. In the early times, when we used to have a minyan on Shabbos, we couldn't even have a minyan on weekdays. People started work at different times. And there was no way that among 11 of us could find a minyan on weekdays, to find a time to suit everybody. So we used to have a minyan on Shabbos. Nobody would go away for a weekend without making sure that the other 10 were there. It didn't happen. And if you found that one of the 10 had already planned a weekend earlier, then they thought about the moment, so he goes. If one had to go on business, there was not any written rule about it. We never talked about it. One was going on business, and obviously he went. It was a holiday, there was a swap. I said, I'll go next week, we'll do that. Or else, I'll find somebody else to do it for me. It would be unheard of for anybody just to not be there. It would certainly be unheard of for anybody not to turn up at the shoe. Then things start changing. The million is well established. 15 people every Shabbat, sometimes 20 people. It was a big milestone when 15 people, sometimes 20 people, because now it's not that essential that I come. If I'm not there, it goes on as well. That feeling of commitment starts from. And there's a million a little bit nearer me, it's raining a little bit, or it's walking there. 3 times backwards and forwards, the commitment starts dropping. What's my finding? The learning is there. The Yiddishkeit is there. Everything is there. But not the mere moment, not the moment. And then we come on to the very sensitive question in a moment of avoiding cultism, which is the danger of what we're talking about. But before that, let's understand that as one starts becoming affluent, as things start going nicely, commitment drops, chametziyut drops, and all that I don't mind. The commitment drops, let chametziyut drop. That ne'emunah drops, that sense of loyalty drops. And when it's more convenient to be somewhere else, that's fine. One has to decide in Torah
where one's going to make the most progress.
I'd say there are 10 places one could be learning, and I have to decide where one's going to make the most progress.
Every one of those 10 places has pros and has cons.
There's certain aspects that one likes about them, there's certain aspects that one doesn't like about them. Ultimately, it's like marrying a wife. One will never find a woman about whom one's happy 100%, except when one's in love, but that doesn't last for the rest of one's life. Ultimately, when one looks at it critically, it's a matter of choosing a woman with whom one is able to function well together, and together with whom one can build a home. And the things about her that get on your nerves, and the things about you that get on her nerves, and that's just too bad. But the good of choose is the one that works best of all. When it comes to learning her at the same time as good. Or when it comes to taking a job, or when it comes to choosing a friend, or when it comes to choosing a country in which to live, whatever it is, it makes no difference. But anything that requires commitment, what you've got to choose out of the bag is the one that's the best of the lot, that has least disadvantages for you and most advantages. But then there has to be a commitment even irrespective of the disadvantages. You can't then say, okay, I'll take this one for its advantages, and I'll take that one for its advantages, and when it doesn't suit me either, I'll take a third one. Because that's no way. And without Mehemoth, there can't be progress, there can't be commitment. Mehemoth is, okay, it's you. We're in this together. But now, it's for better or for worse. And one has to see if one develops as a result of that, that relationship remains for life. If one doesn't develop, one gets divorced, and one moves on. If one does develop, no matter what happens afterwards, that may have moment always remains. One can't have a situation where, from a point of view of their moment, one can't have a situation where I find a bunch of people that are more pleasant to teach. I'll tell you that next month the Shabbos, I'm not going to be there. In fact, I'm never going to be there again. Get yourself somebody else. I'm having more fun over here. I've got a nice group of people. They're really terrific to see. You're also very nice. But these are fantastic. Thanks very much for all the time we spent together. And maybe some other time we'll get together. You can't do that. That's not a relationship. You can't, and vice versa, you can't have a situation. Yeah, that means it's very nice. But sometimes I won't be there. It's a little bit difficult to walk. You can't have such a situation. How can you model it as a middle? If it's just a shul that's there for their convenience, and one pays one's dues to have a shul there, so one comes in and out as one finds it convenient. But that's not Torah, that's not a Beis HaMikdash. Beis HaMikdash is you have a commitment to your chaver, you have a commitment to other people who are expecting you. You have a commitment to the atmosphere in the Beis HaMikdash. You want to say it makes no difference to the Beis HaMikdash whether you're there or you're not, then you shouldn't be there at all. Everybody who comes to the Beis HaMikdash contributes in some way to the atmosphere of the Beis HaMikdash. Everybody is missed if he's not there. Every individual is missed if he's not there. And if you can accept that principle, then you must know that as Mehemonis, you can't just opt out. Of course there are occasions. Of course there are situations which override this principle. Of course there are situations when one can't manage it. But as an example to give you guidance, one is faithful to oneself. What does that mean? That that's the best home in the world? No, it means that's my house. That's where I belong. And what happens if I'm on the other end of town? At night, having a business meeting which finishes at 11 o'clock at night. So I look at my watch and say, I'll see you later. I don't. Why not? Because somebody's expecting me, somebody's waiting for me at home. That's where I belong, and I go. And if it's raining, I go too. And if I can't make it because it's raining so hard, I phone home and I say, I'm going to be late. Somebody's waiting. That's Mayor Mondes. What are you talking about there? And Hakodas Hakodas, appreciating, all that kind of thing, that's a higher level. We're talking about the first level of Midas. Ne'emonis, loyalty. And loyalty to a wife is not that you don't go and live with somebody else. That's not loyalty. This loyalty is if you even admire somebody. That's loyalty, where we are in our soul. Even intellectually, there should be no thought that there's anybody to compare for me at this moment. Not to turn up when you're being expected at home, without a phone call. Not to turn up at all. That's a lack of memory. That can't be done. And so it is with the place that one feels one belongs to, and in Torah, and in one's business, and socially. One has to have frameworks to which one feels a sense of belonging. But let's talk primarily about Torah. Where one chooses that area is a different discussion altogether, and that's not the important and critical thing. the important and critical thing is that once you've chosen it, you feel a belonging. And that's home. That's where you go. Unless you have something specific to do else.
Sure, I'm not in my home 24 hours a day. I go to work, I go to shiurim, I go out to a movie or to a theater, I go out to friends, but those are for specific things. If I'm not doing something specific, I'm at home. I'm not at somebody else's house because it's more convenient to be there. I'm not at somebody else's house because it's nearer my office. I'm not in somebody else's house because I got tired walking. If I'm at somebody else's house because I couldn't make it, and I've sent a message that I couldn't make it, or because I'm doing something specific. Here we come up to the difference between cultism and love. Or rather, before the boundary line between cultism and love. Loyalty becomes cultism when you never go out of your house. No matter what, you're away from home. That's cultism. That narrow-mindedness, that's fanatic. Cultism is when you won't learn Torah from anybody else except your lady. That's what I learned. Close my mind to religion. That's cultism. Where you won't honor and acknowledge the greatness of somebody who doesn't follow your Rebbe's life. That's cultism. Loyalty. Sure, I follow my Rebbe. That's my home. That's where I go home. But I do other things during the day as well. I go out. I honor any Talmud Chacham. I will listen to what any Talmud Chacham has got to say. But in the same way, if as a child I heard something which contradicted my father, I would come home and say, Father, you told me this, and my teacher told me this, and we would discuss it. So it is with my lady. If I hear something which goes against what I'm used to, I'll discuss it with him. That's my base. That's where I start. That's where I finish. I go out from there, and I come back to there. I leave there in the morning, I do my day's work, I come back there in the night. Rosh Hashiva in Yerushalayim was telling me a few months ago what a joy it is to him. Indeed, it is a joy, and not many Rosh Hashivas have the privilege that when boys graduate in yeshiva, and yeshiva is an intermediate sort of yeshiva, for which boys graduate, they're back for Yom. They're back for a Shabbat that we see. If there's a simcha in the house, the first Rosh Hashiva that's there. If there's a problem, they're discussing it with the first Rosh Hashiva. So it makes me feel that this is a home for me. Makes me feel that wherever they'll go in the world, this will be their home. This is where they come back to. Shona Yom Kippur, yes. Face of the Shavuot, yes. They're learning all over the place. They're in Talmud, they're in Chevron, they're all over the place. If comes anything special, they're at home. The children come back. And that's the feeling as it should be, and that's the feeling as it must be. Cultism is A, when you think that your way is good for everybody. I go home at night. I don't have to tell you all to come home with me because mine is the best home. That's not why I go home. I go home because that's where I belong, not because it's the best. And there's confusion in people's minds between loyalty and absolute. Loyalty doesn't mean that your Rebbe is the best, or that your yeshiva is the best, or that your way of Yiddishkeit is the best. That's cultism if you believe that. Loyalty is that where I belong. What is it in whether it's the best or not? I don't throw my parents over if I find better parents. At least I see parents who treat their children better than my parents treated me. Say goodbye, Mom and Dad. I need to live with parents. I tried it once when I was about four, and I never tried it again. And one doesn't do it to a wife. One doesn't do it to one's children. You can't do that. That's not commitment out of which there can be growth. Commitment out of which there can be growth is a commitment of loyalty. That is, that's where I feel comfortable. That's my home. That's where I was started, and that's where I'll always come back. Because I wouldn't be where I am without that. That's what I'm going to do. Not helping. The ability to honor and to respect systems and people who are not one's own home. And stop denigrating other people's houses. That's not loyalty to one's own home. That's helping. And so we find that Ne'emonot, as I mentioned at the outset, is a middle. It's not just an odd situation. Some people have got it, some people haven't. But it's Ne'emonot which determines individuality. If one wants to relate to my house as a bus stop, fine. You're waiting for the bus and you're thirsty and you're coming for a drink, I'll give you a drink. But I don't have to sit down and entertain you. If you want to relate to my house at home, I think it's the same thing. Who determines? The same as far as a child is concerned, the same as far as a visitor is concerned. A person can become a bent body. A person can become what, like one of your children. How does he do it?
You don't go around looking for children to adopt. That's not how it happens. Or for friends to adopt. It's the relationship he builds up with your husband. Comes with them bias because the effect just keeps kicking in. And that's a commitment. Listening to him, listening to you. You can have a person who goes to yeshiva for a couple of years and leaves and then arrives to his yeshiva again, then receives his yeshiva again. Finished. He went for the experience, he got the experience, he came home. That's fine. But he mustn't expect individual attention from his yeshiva. What will determine individual intention is their name on it. And more important, or most important of all, is that that's our relationship with the Rebbe Moshe. We've got to know that those first two commandments were given to all of us. They weren't just given to Adam Moshe. They were given to us, they were given to the Chazanish, they were given to the Pon of the Hero, they were given to the Chavos Chaim. Those first two commandments, they apply to all of us. That's an emotional feeling of exclusive commitment. I mentioned to you once before, if you want a salary increase, and it crosses your mind that your boss have any control over whether you're going to get a salary increase or not, that's a lack of memory. There's no exclusivity. That means you think you're working for two bosses. I am your boss. If you want a salary increase, talk to me. I'll tell you what to do then. Come to me first. That's the exclusivity that is required in our relationship to the Rebbe Moshe. And when there is that loyalty, when there is that emotional understanding, and believe me, it's hard to knock into one's mind that there is no other God but the Rebbe Moshe, that nobody else has any influence over me but God. To knock that into one's mind is hard. But once I have, I can expect a personal relationship with the Rebbe Moshe. When I daven to him, I'm not only davening as one of the tzibur, I'm davening as an individual who he notices. When I'm learning his Torah, I'm not only learning as a group of people, I'm learning as an individual who God notices. When I do a mitzvah, I'm just not one of millions of Jews doing a mitzvah, I'm a special Jew doing a mitzvah who God notices. That relationship, that exclusive relationship, is the consequence of that feeling of love. And it's the relationship which is expressed in the focus. Ani ladoi ladoi li. I belong to God, and God belongs to me. I belong to him, I'm possessed by him, and therefore I can never leave him. But it works both ways. He belongs to me too. And he owes me in fact and undertakes that loyalty in return. Same as the Levine. Aim Kerzu Osi. They brought me close to them. In the Ani Mekare Boson, I will draw them near to me, and they will not be counted. Yes, the whole of Ani Yisrael is counted because they're all precious, every Jew is precious. But you have different kinds of diamonds. You can have little diamonds, or gold, you can have gold dust, which is precious. But one grain of gold dust is not that precious. When you've got it all together, every grain is precious. But one grain on its own is not precious. That's why the Jewish people are sometimes compared to sand. When you've got a whole lot of sand, each grain is important, because if you took away each grain, there would be nothing left. So each grain is important, but take the grain away from the sand, then it's not anything at all. On the other hand, we compare the stars with this. So each star is an individual. When we relate to the Rebbe Moshe with that loyalty, we're like the Kerchov and we're like the star. Not only are we precious, but we're also unique and individual. And we relate to the Rebbe Moshe, and that, we do what everybody does, and we move with everybody, we're affected by everybody, and we're part of the crowd, we're still precious, but not with that same individuality, not with that same degree of Hashgacha Prati. But the Rebbe Moshe says, take the Levim out, everybody must be counted, not the Levim, they're mine. They don't need to be counted, no matter what. Those are the thoughts that I want to leave you with. The understanding of the importance of them are of Maimonides, and to see from here also, people often ask, and it's something you must remember to use. You introduce somebody, if somebody's coming from Israel to collect money for the yeshiva, and if he goes to a businessman, some businessmen will give, some will give more, some will give less, but it will always worry the businessman, what did I get out of it? What is it for me? A businessman is trained not to pass his money unless he gets something in return. What is it for me? So some will understand it's a mitzvah, so he does it for the mitzvah. One must know to explain to a businessman also that if your employees would be yeshiva trained, you would have a different business. You would be able to train. They would be their money, they would be loyal. The economy would be different. Your business would be different. And your interpersonal relationships and office politics would be different. Everything would be different. And that's where Canada takes a man and create a mention out of the Mishkan, in fact, change the whole face of the world, and have to change the face of the world. The tragedy is chas v'sholem. You've got people inside who don't have any money. And you've got people who are involved in Yiddishkeit, and they aren't picking up the essentials of Yiddishkeit, such as essentials of the middle of the emunah, which is the possibility.